It's understandable when people talk about their shortages in certain skills, like if they've never fired a gun or operated a chainsaw or changed a tire. But just adding and subtracting and so on, lots of people demur when asked to perform calculations without a calculator, uttering words to the effect, "I'm not a math person." University of Oregon Assistant Professor Jennifer Roof begs to differ. She says pretty much anybody can do math when they're not feeling a lot of tension, but she also acknowledges the tension all the way up to something she calls math trauma. Jennifer Roof teaches new teachers at the University of Oregon in Education Studies, and she's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Roof.
Good morning, Jeff.
So the beginning point for your research, I mean, did you get tired of hearing people say, "I'm not a math person"?
It's more about what we do to serve children, and hearing people say, "I'm not a math person," gets in the way of people learning and doing mathematics.
And for you, when somebody says, "I'm not a math person," is that like saying, "I'm a unicorn"?
It's not quite like that, but I'll confess that I wince a little bit every time that I hear it. And then if I have the opportunity, I usually ask, "Well, why do you say that?" And the answer is usually grounded in some kind of negative experience or a series of negative experiences that somebody had related to mathematics.
Okay, so what kinds of experiences are we talking about here? Like go up to the board and figure out in front of the class? I can remember that myself.
Yeah, anything that's going to put you in a position where you're afraid of being publicly wrong, or you're afraid that if you're wrong in the mathematics that you do, that there's going to be some negative consequence. And that tends to come in two big ways. One is, as you just described, going to the front of the room and being asked to perform publicly. Another one is anytime that we tie mathematics with speed. So there's this thing called, they're often called mad minutes. It's where students are given a certain number of calculation problems and told they needed to do them as quickly as possible. And for many reasons, these things still continue. They persist in math classrooms. The common thread here is that when we're under pressure and we're trying to do something that we're not already what we call fluent in, meaning that we have easy fact recall, it shuts down our working memory. This makes it really difficult to actually do the mathematics, and so you feel like you're failing because actually your brain isn't working in those moments, and then you start to think it's because you're just not a math person.
We hear a lot about the brain and its capacity for fight, flight, or freeze. This is truly the freeze, isn't it?
It is. It's also commonly referred to as choking.
It seems like that the knowledge would have been out there for a while. If this many people in society have bad memories of being asked to perform in math, then perhaps the approach might have changed sooner than now?
So if you look back across the field of math and math education, you'll see that the promoting these shifts really started in the late 80s. And we've made great strides, especially in K through 8 mathematics. We tend to see more of a holdout in high school and post-high school mathematics education. I think this is for some, there's some historical reasons. It basically boils down to people's beliefs about what it means to do mathematics and what it means to be good at mathematics.
You mean in the sense of people thinking you're a nerd if you know how to do math?
It's more that people think that being good at math means you're fast and you're accurate. And what we're trying to do as math educators and teacher educators is shift the perception so that math means being persistent, it means working hard at something, it means asking questions, it means thinking, well, I don't know this yet, what's it going to take for me to understand it? And it means listening to other people and how they understand mathematics so you start to build this really rich, robust understanding of how it works. It's not just getting the answer, it's understanding how to get the answer.
Ah, so for all those times we sit around and say, well, I could never think that fast, I guess I'm no good at math, maybe the first part is true and the second isn't.
That's absolutely correct, yeah. So if you can reframe your thinking about what it means to be good at math and cultivate a sense of wonder and joy, and I'm not there yet, that's one of the first steps in reframing yourself as a math person.
Jennifer Roof is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an assistant professor in education studies at the University of Oregon, talking about math trauma and the fact that we could all be math people indeed. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Share your stories of math issues or math proficiency. We'll take it either way. 800-838-3760 by phone for your questions and comments. You can also send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Jennifer, you teach teachers now, but you taught students in the classroom for decades, apparently. Do you find it's a generational thing that kids hear their parents talk of hating math and assume that they do too, or that's just not, you know, a thing our family doesn't do?
I do think that it's shifting. You know, I'm definitely of a generation that tied speed and accuracy with being good at mathematics. And I do think that one of the biggest impacts on the ways that we think about learning in general, and certainly mathematics, is mindset theory. This comes from Carol Dweck's. You may have heard of the term growth mindset. It's the idea that, you know, we're born with a certain amount of intelligence, or that we grow our knowledge and intelligence through practice. And so I think that in the last decade, we've really seen that tide start to turn.
So I have to believe then you probably get some people who you're training to be teachers who also tell you they're not math people. Or do you tell them in the first class, don't ever say that to me?
Well, you know, I actually wouldn't want to shut down people expressing that, because I think that acknowledging it is a very important first step in figuring out where you're going to go next. But yeah, it's actually a really big issue in the United States. We have a large number of elementary school teachers who do have a certain amounts of math anxiety and suffer from even math trauma. And so one of the first things that I get to do in working with pre-service teachers, people who are learning to become teachers, is help them explore their own history with mathematics, looking at not just the negative moments, but also the really positive ones, and then helping them to reframe mathematics learning in new ways. I mean, more and more people are coming to me with positive experiences, and so this is exciting. But yeah, I mean, that's actually a big part of the work that we do.
Is math anxiety the less severe form of math trauma on your scale?
Yeah, I think that it would be hard to find a human being who hasn't experienced math anxiety at some point or another. People who suffer from math trauma actually will report, you know, breaking out in a cold sweat, feeling their heart race, really exacerbated physical symptoms related to math anxiety. And I have worked with a number of people who've experienced that.
Our studios used to be located next to a classroom where there were math classes most of the day, and one of our producers would report going past there and feeling a little nauseous. So,
yeah,
aware of this. Yeah. So then it's real, though. I mean, these people really feel this. And, you know, you don't fake going into a cold sweat. I mean, nobody acts that good. So then how do you go beyond that? How do you reach beyond the barrier and get students to realize that math is something other than something to be feared?
One of the most important things that we do here at the University of Oregon is design classes that are I'll go ahead and say that they're therapeutic experiences.
Uh-huh.
So we want our students to experience learning and doing mathematics in the ways that we are asking them to go out and then teach mathematics to children. So we engage in states of not knowing yet. We engage in states of what we call rough draft talk, where you share what your current thinking is, and then we workshop those ideas publicly. So we normalize the idea that it's important to not know something in mathematics, because that's how you actually learn anything. And we practice presenting publicly and sharing our thinking. And my students report to me that, you know, they do feel some anxiety about this public work. But across the course of the class that we have together, they grow into a feeling of comfort. So the key elements here are to develop a classroom culture where we normalize taking risks and sharing your thinking publicly. And we do this by making the space emotionally safe as possible, so that, you know, being wrong is actually something to celebrate, because it means that we've got something interesting to talk about.
Okay, so that's a culture that the teacher really has to develop then, the ability for people to not have the right answer but not feel like you're wrong.
Absolutely. You said it very eloquently.
All right, we're talking to Jennifer Roof at the University of Oregon, Assistant Professor of Education Studies, about math trauma, math anxiety, the fact that by having to go do problems on the board or take high-speed tests, a lot of us have been traumatized on math, and we need not be, and she's explaining how. Join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's a step you remark upon in your writing about a sense-making step. I mean, so we're talking about essentially relating math to things that students experience in their own worlds.
Yes, and, you know, when you asked why are we still teaching and learning mathematics in ways that we know are problematic, in part that relates to theories of learning. So when I talk about sense-making, I'm talking about a particular group of theories of learning, which we call constructivism. It means that the ways that we come to know anything in the world start with what we already know. So we take in understanding by all forms of evidence, any kind of sensory input, which includes smell and touch and sight and sound. We don't tend to taste very much in math classrooms, but especially when you're working with younger children, you know, division problems with fractions and brownies, you certainly can taste things.
Yeah.
But I digress. My point is just that we start with what children already know, and this is one of the most important things that teachers learn, is that they start by assessing what their kids already know, and then we construct learning experiences to help stretch and grow into new things. So when we talk about sense-making, that's related. It means that you come to know mathematics by making sense of it, and that's connecting what you already know about mathematics to the things that you're learning next. And when we make sense of mathematics, we tend to build much more robust and connected understanding and memory. And this makes it easier and easier to do mathematics as you continue to build that understanding.
I have to admit, pictures make things easier. I read the piece you wrote for Education Week. It was published a couple of other places, I guess. And just looking at the way you grouped the concept of 3 times 5 equals 15 in certain sets of pictures, it was a lot easier to digest than the flashcards I remember from school.
Yeah, and if you've looked at that picture, that's from a piece in Education Week for teachers. There's a picture on the far left. It's a rectangle. Mm-hmm. It's broken down into squares. So you have three columns of five or five rows of three. Either way, you have 15 squares total. That's actually a flashcard. So you can create flashcards from what we call area models or array, which shows those groupings of 3 by 5. And that's a very fast way for teachers to assess the level of fact fluency, or even what you can go to the level of what we call automaticity, which is where you just know 3 times 5 is 15. And if you work with math facts like that long enough, you do get to the level of automaticity.
That's funny. I do remember that particular drawing, and it was the least interesting to me. It actually had 3 times 5 written out in the middle.
That's right, and that's because it's actually a flashcard.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's the one I remember the least of that set. Isn't that interesting? Okay. Have you had moments, I imagine there have been many over the years, Jennifer, when you saw the fear or the resistance developing? Where people were starting to get some level of math anxiety or something, and you had a chance to smooth things over in the moment?
Yeah, that's one of the most rewarding parts of this job, is when you see something in real time like that, and you feel like you have the you're in a position where you can help somebody. You know, I think, and the moments that really stand out for you are the moments where you feel like you didn't quite make it as a teacher. Those are the most instructive moments for me. Those are my not yet moments. But yeah, I get a lot of feedback from my students at the end of the quarter, and sometimes they'll even write me emails years later expressing how the work that we did together in class really helped them to normalize a sense of not knowing as being productive, and it, you know, they can feel anxiety dropping and excitement and wonder growing. And when I think about those teachers going out and working with their own students, that's when I get most excited.
Sure, because you've had a chance to teach the teachers who are then teaching other people and spreading it all down the line. Are there moments, though, when educators, either of students or of other educators, have to punt, recognize that the trauma is rising and move on to another subject or change approaches?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's I'm remembering. I mean, I spent decades teaching freshmen algebra, and there are certain topics in particular that I remember as being sort of flashpoints. And if you recognize that somebody's at a point where they're basically just in a spin cycle of anxiety about the mathematics, it's time to walk away for the day. It doesn't mean we don't come back to it, but you take a break and then you regroup and you come back and you think about a new approach to helping that person make sense of it.
Okay, something that gets talked about at work a lot now, too. If you're in the middle of a problem, walk away from it for a while and come back, and you'll be a little fresher.
Yeah,
mind.
Yeah. I like to think of it as if you're looking at the problem. You know, like I taught in the 90s. We used chalkboards a lot. And you could fill a chalkboard with a math problem if it's big enough and dense enough. And you could imagine walking up really close to the chalkboard and zooming in on a little piece of it. Or you could walk away and stand on the other side of the room and look at the whole thing from a distance. So, you know, this idea of walking away from something and letting it rest, or walking away from something and getting a new perspective on it, both really powerful ideas. Some of my best thinking happens even when I'm sleeping. I imagine many of us have had the experience of waking up and suddenly having new clarity on some problem that they were wrestling with the day before. And I think it's that idea of taking a break from it.
I know the feeling. About a minute and a half left here, Jennifer. I want to get in before we go, though, the fact that this gets bigger than math and education. You see some social justice and equity issues wrapped up with math education. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. Well, in a minute and a half, math historically, there are certain people who have been thought of as good at math. And I remember one of the most exciting moments in my career actually happened in the mid-90s. I was teaching sixth graders. And I was really excited because I came into class and I showed them some test data from the national, from some national test data that showed that for the first time they had closed the gap between girls' and boys' performance on this math test. And one of my sixth grade girls literally leaped out of her seat, and she said, "Who would ever say that boys are better at math than girls?" And I thought, wow, well, that's great. You know, like, here's this whole generation of children who don't believe that there's a gender difference in who can and can't do math. So I'll just sum it up by saying that there are some pretty pernicious ideas and cultural ideas about who can and can't do math. And it has to do with race, it has to do with gender, it has to do with socioeconomic status, all of these things. And so one of the things that my research does is look for examples of brilliance in mathematics across all of those different social descriptions. Mm-hmm. And what I can tell you is that all of us are capable of deep and powerful mathematical reasoning, understanding, and knowledge.
Okay. Well, I realized I put you under some testing anxiety there, and I'm sorry about that, but you did beautifully. Jennifer Roof, Assistant Professor of Education Studies at the University of Oregon, thank you so much.